From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The anguished cries of MSNBC's Chris Matthews are still reverberating after what most pundits and viewers deemed a lackluster performance by the president in his first debate against Republican challenger Mitt Romney.
I don't know what he was doing out there. He had his head down. He was enduring the debate rather than fighting it. Romney, on the other hand, came in with a campaign. He had a plan. He was going to dominate the time. He was going to be aggressive. He's going to push the moderator around, which he did effectively. He was going to relish the evening, enjoying it. Nothing to do with the words he spoke. Here's my question for Obama. I know he likes to say he doesn't watch cable television, but maybe he should start.
Most notably, MSNBC, where they know how to debate these issues.
We got it on tape what you think of these people. Don't come out here and pretend you care about old people because you met somebody at some campaign event. You've written off 47% of the country before you even started. Where was Obama tonight? He should watch. Well, not just hardball. Rachel should watch you, and should watch the Reverend Al, should watch Lawrence. He would learn something about this debate.
Meanwhile, pundits anxiously or eagerly, depending on the channel, assessed the impact of the debate on the election, because that's what pundits do. They prognosticate, like Fox's Neil Cavuto.
This isn't a matter of Mitt Romney potentially winning over undecided voters, but possibly Barack Obama voters.
Well, to be honest, I doubt that that will happen, Neil. I don't think that's it at all.
Do you want me to have another ice cream bet with you, young man?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm just simply, okay. I was trying to say in a nice way, Neil, you're completely wrong.
Okay, there we go, man. Now you're pulling a Mitt Romney on me.
Pundits are paid to ruminate, to ponder, to guess. 2 months ago, conservative pundit Dick Morris, who never seems willing to concede that he's guessing, said this.
I am quite confident that Romney is clearly going to carry Florida. I think he's going to carry Ohio. And I think he has a very good shot at carrying Pennsylvania.
Then last week, with most polls showing Romney trailing Obama in Pennsylvania, Fox's Bill O'Reilly brought Morris in to see how he was adjusting to the new data, or not.
You're standing by everything, yeah. Right?
Yeah. When you average 9 inaccurate polls, you get 1 inaccurate average. There's a deliberate effort going on in the media to try to discourage Romney people and encourage Obama donors by portraying this race as an Obama walk. But the people that are taking accurate polls, the people I'm in touch with, people who work with me, and Scott Rasmussen, the only pollster that really is doing it correctly, all have this race very different.
Like many pundits, Morris has his story and he's sticking to it. It's a living. But the fact is, as you'll soon hear, most pundits prognosticate with pretty much the reliability of a magic eight ball. Of course, the classic magic eight ball offers more nuance and humility than pundits like Morris. After all, among its 20 possible answers, 5 are noncommittal, as in cannot predict now or reply hazy, try again.
Nate Silver of the New York Times 538 blog has a new book out titled The Signal and the Noise, Why So Many Predictions Fail, But Some Don't. In it, he cites a landmark study by psychologist Philip Tetlock, who evaluated a sample of political experts on their ability to predict events. Every month for a total of 2 decades, Tetlock asked each expert to predict the likelihood of possible future events, from Quebec seceding from Canada to the fall of the Soviet Union. The results, says Silver, were embarrassing. The experts performed barely any better than random chance, though, interestingly, they didn't all perform equally badly.
One class of people did a little bit better, and that's what he called foxes. Ironically, they're the people who are not looking for a perfect prediction. They're looking to take different types of information, consider different hypotheses, and acknowledge that the world is complicated. The hedgehogs, who are the counterpart to the foxes, tend to be big believers in a grand, unified theory. So they see everything through the prism of, say, class conflict, or everything through the prism of, oh, media bias, potentially, or they think they're right about everything pretty much through their theoretical conceptions of how things behave.
The people who are pundits on TV making political prognostications, I'm going to assume they're not foxes, they're hedgehogs.
So one other component of the study that Tetlock did is he looked at how many mainstream media appearances the people in his survey panel had done. And he found that the more often people did media, the worse their forecasts were. Because then they have incentives to say outlandish things. And I talk about the example of Dick Morris in March of this year said he thought Donald Trump would run and be a very formidable candidate in the Republican primaries, who in 2008 said Barack Obama would win like Tennessee and West Virginia, who thought that Hurricane Katrina would help President Bush. You could almost create a hedge fund just betting against whatever he says, but he still remains in the kind of regular news rotation and people take him seriously.
There is no penalty in the world of television punditry for being wrong. There's a great incentive to be bold.
The classic media bias is rooting for the story. Certainly after the conventions, I think the press became very interested in the Romney is imploding story. But in the long run, people sell more papers and get more listeners and viewers if you have a close down-to-the-wire election. And so in 2008, on the McLaughlin Group, the long-running show where they have four reporters come on, or four pundits, I guess, depending on how flattering you want to be toward them. The weekend before the 2008 election, this was a time when Barack Obama led by 7 points in the national polls. He led in almost literally every single poll of every single swing state. The economy had collapsed. But three of the four panelists of the McLaughlin Group said it was too close to call. Monica Crowley actually said she thought McCain would win by half a point. The next week on the same show, she implied that Obama's win had been inevitable because the economy had collapsed, all the obvious things which she had neglected to consider like literally a week earlier. It's like the whole group has amnesia.
When you read 538 blog, you get like a weather forecast. There's a 90% chance of rain.
Sure.
Means that 90% of the time under identical conditions, it's going to rain. That's how you do it?
That's how we do it, because we're not pretending that we can make an exact forecast of an election. If you're in early October, there are a lot of contingencies that could move the polls, but we have some sense for what the relative probabilities are. So presidential debates, for example, have sometimes moved the polls by about 3 points. There have been cases where even on election day, there were late-breaking developments, like in 2000 when George W. Bush was revealed to have had a DUI arrest that moved the numbers. And there's ambiguity based on the fact that only about 10% of people now respond to surveys, even to the best, most thorough surveys. And so all pollsters are hopeful that the 10% of people that do answer the polls are representative of the 90% who don't, but who might vote in the actual election anyway. So there is some ambiguity, but we can use history to say how accurate have the polls been at different points in the campaign and give you the betting odds like a handicapper would.
In your book, you cite that more than 90% of all data collected in human history has been amassed in the last
2 years,
which you would think would enable us to crunch the numbers and be extraordinarily accurate in predicting all sorts of things. But,
well, a lot of that data is like cat videos on YouTube or Justin Bieber testimonials sent via text message. So we certainly haven't produced 90% of all the useful information in the past 2 years. For example, we're at the point in the election now where you get maybe 20 or 30 polls every day between state polls and national polls. If you're a Romney supporter and you pick the three of those polls you like best based on random variance and anything else, you'll always be able to tell a happy story about what happened. If you're an Obama supporter, of course, you can do the same thing. So if people are going to cherry pick the evidence, when you give them more of a choice, then they can isolate themselves more from what an objective forecaster might say.
In the introduction to your book, you talk about two historical watersheds that changed our thinking about prognostication. One was the printing press.
Before the invention of the printing press in the 1400s, knowledge was really, really expensive. It literally cost the equivalent of $20,000 to copy a book manuscript. And then all of a sudden, with Gutenberg's invention, you could mass produce books, and you had finally the accumulation of knowledge. But you had 200 years of holy war first. The Protestant Reformation was directly tied to the printing press. People were going to disagree about their interpretations of the Bible or of other things. And now they had evidence to prove their point of view. And you had a very bloody couple of centuries before you finally saw progress made, but it took 200 years. Now we have a similar step change in information, which is caused by the internet. I'm 34, right? when I was growing up, you actually had to wait for the morning paper to come out to see the baseball box score. You know, it was kind of astounding now. But we haven't developed our protocols for how we use all that information. And I think it's just like after the printing press led to a lot of conflict and partisanship and mistakes for the time being.
Well, if your analogy is right, then maybe now that society is getting used to this growing amount of data, we're headed towards a new enlightenment?
Well, I'm not sure about that either. I mean, people think, oh, as information increases, you'll reach some singularity. I do think we have to also acknowledge that as cool as our computers and our technology might be, it's still humans who have to design them and implement them. If you input garbage into a model, it'll spit garbage out. We're going to make some mistakes at first, as we have. I mean, everything from the financial crisis to the earthquake in Japan were not predicted, or in the case of Japan, were predicted not to happen. The seismologists there thought you couldn't have an earthquake that large. But I do think as we get better at knowing where our technology can help us and where it might lead us astray, where you still need human judgment, and where you can kind of press the on switch and turn things over to the machines, then we'll begin to make progress. But the point of the book, I suppose, is the sooner that we admit that we have a problem, that we're not as good as prediction as we think we are, then we can move toward enlightenment one step at a time.
Nate, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Nate Silver writes the 538 blog for the New York Times and is author of The Signal and the Noise, Why So Many Predictions Fail, But Some Don't.
Coming up, the media narrative of Muslim rage is becoming a joke, but it's not funny.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the internet. More at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems, the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org, and the SCAN Foundation, committed to aging with dignity and independence, at thescanfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. It was an indelible moment in this week's presidential debate.
I'm going to stop the subsidy to PBS. I'm going to stop other things. I like PBS. I love Big Bird. Actually, like you, too. But I'm not going to keep on spending money on things to borrow money from China to pay for.
We didn't know that Big Bird was driving the federal deficit. But that's what we heard last night. How about that? Elmo, too?
Romney was hardly the first politician to raise the sensitive issue of Sesame Street's importance to the nation. It happens all the time. And with it comes the inevitable question, what would happen if that support abruptly went away? The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, created in 1967, has an annual budget of about $446 million. That money is dispersed to public radio and television stations around the country and indirectly to NPR. As it happens, government funding makes up only a small percentage of many stations' budgets. For instance, here at WNYC, we're told it's around 6%. Nevertheless, in a time of economic recession, should the government reconsider its funding for public broadcasting? In 2010, Reason.com editor Nick Gillespie told us, yes.
I support defunding not because I dislike art, not because I dislike culture or dislike radio or many things on PBS, but precisely because I like them. And I think that it's time to take away the small sliver of funding that allows a lot of political interference and annoyance. The small amount of funding that NPR gets from various sources from the federal government, that allows people like John Boehner, and it allows Democrats at various points to kind of hue and cry, and you pull that plank out from under them, I don't think that the quality and the mission of NPR would suffer, and you would shut up loudmouths who are always looking to grab a microphone or get in front of a TV camera.
If you listen to, say, morning radio, one of the most popular shows is Morning Edition. Substantive, informative. Would such a program exist if it were as obsessed with the bottom line as so much of the rest of radio is?
I am extremely confident that NPR's nonprofit ethos would survive any cut in federal spending. And in fact, it might even grow stronger. The federal government is broke, and it's only going to get more and more broke. And at this point, we need to say, what are the core functions of government? And I think most people would agree that defense is one of them. Courts, maybe citizenship, things like that. The idea that we have an inalienable right to Car Talk or to Sesame Street on tax-supported airwaves, that strikes me as a stretch. And it's time to rethink that, not because those are bad programs, but because they're not core functions of government, and they will be funded via other avenues. I think that the analogous model here is religion and religious expression. We all want to live in a world where everybody can worship whatever God they want, but nobody is forced to pay for other people's belief systems, whether we're talking about Presbyterians and Baptists or Fox News enthusiasts and PBS tote bag holders.
I guess fundamentally, this all boils down to what you think of public broadcasting. If you think it's a left-wing, inflected source of information, then there would be no reason to support it. But if you think, you know, going back to that old chestnut, that it actually leads to a more informed electorate that can make a better democracy, then you might have a different view.
In my case, this is completely viewpoint neutral. It doesn't matter to me what is being said. It matters how it's being funded. I mean, every historian of both LBJ and Richard Nixon will tell you that they applied pressure directly and indirectly to over-the-air broadcasters.
That is true, but most of that pressure has, in fact, been lifted. I mean, the fairness doctrine has been a thing of the past since Reagan.
Why not finish the job then and, you know, shut John Boehner up, shut Eric Cantor up, shut Michelle Bachmann up, from being able to say, you know what, I'm paying for this microphone, so it better reflect what I think and what I feel. You know, one of the things that the architects of public broadcasting in the late 60s could not foresee was the vast multiplication of sites of production and consumption of media, but also the models.
Although there certainly is a lot more verbiage, just having a lot of people yelling at you 24 hours a day does not mean that we are swimming in a salubrious sea of useful information.
Just as there are more people screaming and shouting and also uncovering really interesting stories, there are also agencies and groups and filters that check and double check and triple check. We have never lived in a richer, better time for journalism and for information and for public discourse than we do right now.
I totally buy that.
And for that reason, screw the public interest if you are going to define it in some kind of 1965 best and the brightest mentality. That's an old and dangerous version of the public interest. The public interest is every time people are going online or turning on the TV or the radio and getting information and processing it. And we're going gangbusters. We don't need a tax on that.
Nick, thank you very much.
My pleasure. And the minute that the federal government actually defunds NPR, my checkbook will be open to at least make up my differential.
You are too kind. Nick Gillespie is editor-in-chief of Reason.com and Reason.tv.
Around the time we originally spoke with Nick Gillespie, Steve Coll, president and CEO of the New America Foundation, wrote an open letter to the Federal Communications Commission. In it, he argued we should reformulate media policy here in the U.S., starting with more funding for public media, which Coll says was created to raise the level of public discourse.
The purpose was to add to the mix the kind of programming and mission that commercial broadcasters will not find profitable, but which is nonetheless in the public interest. I'm not arguing that we shouldn't have a commercially dominated media. I am arguing that the commercially dominated media does not produce public interest journalism adequately.
The fact is, Steve, that public broadcasting has become kind of a political piñata. It is deemed to represent a liberal worldview that some on the right just don't want to subsidize in any way, shape, or form. Is there a way around that philosophical objection to the tone or the values of public broadcast?
First, we shouldn't overinterpret the criticism, but we should listen to it. At the same time, in order to carry out its role, like the Federal Reserve or the Securities and Exchange Commission or your local prosecutor, it requires a certain degree of professional independence. And so the best thing to do is to strengthen the independence of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting while holding it accountable across the political spectrum.
So Nick Gillespie's solution is to defund public broadcasting and end the argument about whether public broadcast is too politically inflected. You have a slightly different approach. You say, as a society, we should double down. We should increase the funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. What's the scheme?
The idea that originates in the law that commercial broadcasters using public spectrum have an obligation to serve the public in exchange for that privilege, that idea has evolved into a farcical system in which the commercial broadcasters essentially fill out forms that they keep in their own offices saying, well, we did some crime reporting yesterday, so we've educated the public about spousal abuse or child abuse. It doesn't serve the public, but it wastes a lot of money. So the essence of it is that you relieve the commercial broadcasters of their expensive and ineffective public interest obligation and instead extract spectrum usage fees that can be directed to strengthen public media. And in addition, the FCC is overseeing multi-billion dollar new spectrum auctions, and it would be quite simple to tack into those auctions user fees that could be directed to public broadcasting. And I promise you, as a percentage of the profits that they will make from those spectrum auctions, the fees we're talking about are a fraction of what they pay their investment bankers just to get to the table.
That said, your open letter to the FCC predated by about 3 days a gigantic sweep in the midterm elections of Republicans into Congress. I'm going to take a wild stab here and say you haven't gotten a call from John Boehner's office saying, why, Steve, tell me more about your plan.
It's early. He's making a lot of calls this week. I do think that it is in the interests of all political actors in the United States to have a healthy public broadcasting system. Look, what is it like to be a professional politician in this environment? The internet can come alive with false rumors about your conduct. If you go on television to try to make yourself heard, you've got 20 seconds and it may be a shouting match with somebody on the other side, but it is in their mutual interest to construct, as Britain has, a public broadcasting system where civil, deep, serious, inclusive debate about the issues of the day can take place. I mean, if you've lived in Britain and you turn on their morning public broadcasting shows, you could not paint them politically. But what you do find is that everybody who's a political actor has time to make their arguments.
You're talking about a continent that has primetime programming devoted to literary criticism. These people are not like you and me. Is there any chance that a long-form political conversation and debate would get any kind of audience if there's not someone from Fox News or MSNBC to immoderate the discussion?
But we have that evidence now, and it's in the ratings of your network. Look at the combined audiences of Morning Edition and All Things Considered. They exceed the combined audiences of the morning shows of the major networks.
That large audience, though, isn't it like the very elite that the likes of Michelle Bachmann and Sarah Palin like to denounce?
It has demographic limitations. It tends to be white and rural and old in comparison to the national population. And part of the purpose of revitalizing public media would be to make it younger and more like America in its ethnic and racial makeup. But it's too large to be elite.
Steve, as always, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Bob. Thanks for having me on.
Steve Kahl is president and CEO of the New America Foundation. As protests erupted last month throughout the Muslim world, Western media followed an increasingly familiar line. One focused on bitter anti-Americanism, the Arab Spring unraveling the clash of civilizations. Most infamously, Newsweek magazine published a cover featuring bearded male protesters in traditional Islamic garb screaming and jostling one another below the words "Muslim Rage" in big block letters. In a series of posts at foreignpolicy.com, Mark Lynch, director of the Institute for Middle East Studies at George Washington University and informal advisor to the Obama campaign, argues that most of the coverage got the story exactly backwards.
I don't think any of us will forget the images of American embassies on fire or of Ambassador Stevens being dragged through the streets of Benghazi. Those were horrible images, and it's obvious why those led every media outlet. But the really important thing to understand about what happened was how small those protests actually were compared to, say, the millions of people in Tahrir Square a year and a half earlier, or even the protests which you would see on almost a weekly basis over the course of last year on issues related to the economy or politics or police abuse or all the other things that Egyptians get worked up about.
So at that point, all of the question headlines, and you know what I'm talking about on cable news where the crawl promotes a coming story and it says, failure of the Arab Spring? In fact, you say, a new spirit of democracy was evident in the aftermath of this attack.
It really is significant that those protests, after all the storm and anger, just how quickly they faded away and how other groups responded. So, for example, in Tunisia, the president, a democratically elected, real legitimacy, immediately goes out of his way to declare the people who carried out the attacks on the embassy to be radical extremists, promises to crack down, even promises to pay for the damages to the American school, which, given the state of Tunisia's economy, I certainly hope they don't. In Benghazi, in Libya, you saw something almost unprecedented. 30,000 people come out into the streets to denounce extremism, to denounce the killing of the American ambassador, and to demand the disarming of the militias. This is something which deserved a lot more coverage than it got, but it didn't fit the story. It didn't fit the script.
On the verge of being charitable towards the press, because in the heat of a breaking news story, they report the facts. And the facts feed a certain narrative. There is not really an appetite for a whole lot of context and nuance. But absent the context, isn't there a grave danger of doing real harm?
I think you're right. These narratives of Muslim rage or the Islamic winter are so easy and so convenient, and people will believe them. And it's missing things which are so important about these changing societies in the Arab world. They'll report the bearded men with torches at the embassy and then completely ignore the civil society activists who are demanding an end to corruption or the protesters demanding a living wage. And I do think that's a major problem, which I had thought that Tahrir Square and the Arab Spring would have ended.
You've had conversations with reporters who are on the ground in the Middle East who indicated to you that they absolutely understand that the pockets of violence are isolated and that the dynamics are extremely nuanced, and yet laughed because they trotted out that very narrative that began our conversation.
It's simply impossible to ignore the imagery of a burning embassy. No journalist could have or should have. But then it falls almost immediately into a certain script. This was the Danish cartoons crisis, the clash of civilizations. And once you're in that script, editors expect a certain thing, viewers expect a certain thing. And I think the journalists, if they come back with a story that basically says, well, yes, there was a mob outside the American embassy, but let's talk about the Tunisian economy, I'm fairly sure the story will get sent back for re-editing.
You noted that social media, in the wake of the Newsweek headline, did not get all riled up about Islam. It got all riled up about Newsweek.
There was plenty of anger against Muslims for their rage out there in social media, but there was a very unusual and I think important development, and that was the appropriation of the Muslim rage hashtag, which Newsweek coined in order to spark a discussion about its incendiary cover. And almost immediately what happened was Muslims and others appropriated that hashtag and began turning it into a joke. My favorite was, my son is named Jihad and I can't yell at him in the airport. Muslim rage. Or, you know, I'm having a good hair day and nobody knows it because of my hijab. Muslim rage. You know, this is funny, it's trivial, but it also speaks to the ability of people to speak back now. They don't have to accept the narratives that the media is offering them. And many of the journalists who were writing the stories and the editors who were commissioning the stories are on Twitter, they're following that hashtag, and they quickly realize that their storyline is becoming a joke. And so I do think that at some small level, that probably changed the way the coverage went. Is that enough to break this prevailing script? I don't know, but it certainly changed the way it was received, at least among the attentive public and, you know, these policy people who are engaged heavily on these social networks.
If you're right that social media gets a chance to talk back and chasten the Western press, to call it on laziness and simplistic narratives, you know, is there any evidence at this point that it's having an effect?
If you have some kind of virtual relationship with journalists over Twitter and they've come to trust your judgment over repeated interactions, I think you can actually have an influence now. The ability of people to push back against such narratives is growing. So the days of that might soon end, or not.
Indeed. Mark, as always, thank you.
Well, thanks for having me.
Mark Lynch is author of The Arab Uprising: The Unfinished Revolutions of the New Middle East.
Coming up, why illusionist David Blaine is shocked.
And why the press can't get enough of it. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the Internet. More at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Imagine this. Soon after a Democrat promising hope and change enters the White House, having dislodged an unpopular Republican amid an economic crisis, unemployment remains at alarmingly high levels. As an election approaches, the president's opponents label him and his policies nothing less than socialism. That's a description more or less ripped from the headlines during a California governor's race in 1934. As Greg Mitchell, columnist for TheNation.com, described it to us in 2010, it was one of the country's most closely watched races because it was seen as a judgment on FDR's New Deal. That's because, seemingly out of nowhere, the Democratic primary in California had been won by a man who might rightly have been accused of socialism, Upton Sinclair, the journalist and muckraking author of The Jungle. Sinclair rose to political prominence after he launched a hugely popular anti-poverty campaign.
There's no excuse for poverty in a state as rich as California. We can produce so much food that we have to dump it into our bay.
Mitchell told us that the reaction to Sinclair's primary win was swift and terrible, ushering in the first modern media campaign. Greg, welcome to the show.
Oh, I'm very happy to be here.
So in your preface, you describe Upton Sinclair as a muckraking author, militant vegetarian, erstwhile socialist, and scourge of the ruling class. Given those descriptors, how had Sinclair won the primary for California governor in 1934 to begin with?
Well, he decided he had written enough and decided to change his affiliation from socialist and enter the Democratic primary. He led a mass movement called End Poverty in California, or EPIC, and managed to sweep the Democratic primary in a landslide with hundreds of thousands of votes and was the favorite to win in November.
So people knew who they were voting for.
Oh, absolutely. He was one of the most famous authors in the world. Today, we remember him mainly for The Jungle, but at the time, he was always in and out of the headlines, getting arrested, and was certainly a famous figure in California and around the country.
As you describe it, the swiftest response to his winning the primary came from newspaper magnates like William Randolph Hearst and the Chandlers,
right,
the family behind the Los Angeles Times, and also Hollywood.
Well, of course, the newspapers at that time were extremely reactionary throughout the state. They were owned by families that had a lot of money at stake. And you know, Sinclair, bless his heart, had been one of the leading media critics of his day. We think of Sinclair today as this muckraker, like an investigative journalist or something. He was mainly a novelist, and even The Jungle is a novel. So what the newspapers would do is they would take some outrageous thing that a character in one of Sinclair's novels said and would pretend that Sinclair had said it himself. So they would put it right on the front page and have him believing in free love and giving away money to everyone and hating the church. So yeah, the newspapers were in the forefront of the fight.
The Los Angeles Times also took shots at Sinclair's followers.
Yeah, they called him the maggot-like horror. Then it was so over the top.
The political editor of the Los Angeles Times was a real kingmaker. His name was Kyle Palmer. And you cite this really amazing anecdote when he's having a conversation with the New York Times' star reporter, right, who was in California, a guy named Turner Catledge.
Turner came out there to cover the campaign in a fairly even-handed way and was amazed there was no coverage about Sinclair at all in the LA Times except for all the negative shots. And so he asked Kyle Palmer, how can you get away with only covering one campaign? And Palmer said, Turner, forget it. We don't go in for that kind of crap that you have back in New York of being obliged to print both sides. We're going to beat this son of a bitch, Sinclair, any way we can. We're going to kill him.
Quote, unquote. Okay, so what was Hollywood's beef with Upton Sinclair?
They thought that Sinclair and his former socialistic background was a threat to the movie industry itself. And so the first thing they did was they threatened to move to Florida. When that didn't work, they docked each of their employees one day's pay to be donated then to the GOP candidate. And then finally, Irving Thalberg at MGM made these newsreels that presented Sinclair and his supporters in the worst possible light and were actually mainly faked footage. Some of it was shot on the studio lot. They hired actors to portray bums and other Sinclair supporters.
This was the famous humanitarian, Irving Thalberg?
Yeah. He admitted it after the campaign that he was the one. And I managed to find these newsreels. They were sort of missing to history. They were really the first attack ads on the screen. And people back then got a lot of their news off the newsreels, and they thought they were the straight deal.
You say that this campaign marked the beginning of media politics. I want you to make that argument for me, because certainly negative advertising did not begin with the gubernatorial campaign of Upton Sinclair.
There, of course, had been dirty campaigns before this, but campaigns had always been run by political parties and their local leaders. But the Sinclair threat was so great, they turned the campaign over for the first time to what we now call political consultants, to PR people we now call spin doctors. This is the first turning over of the campaign to advertising people. The use of radio and the screen to make attack ads and national fundraising from all over the country in one state race. All of those things were unprecedented.
What was the substance of these smears that made it so unprecedented?
Sinclair said that if he was elected, California would become such a paradise that the unemployed would want to come to California. And of course, he was just joking about it. But they took that and they made radio dramas around it. They made two of these fake newsreels around it. They plastered it on billboards all over the state.
Horrific images of huddled masses,
right,
crowding into California.
Your inquiring cameraman interviewed 30 stated that they were on their way to California to spend the winter and to remain there permanently if the epic plan went into effect.
Hearst owned movie theaters, so he worked with MGM to get these newsreels into his movie theaters. You had all these people on every level of radio, newspapers, movies, advertising, all in the same room and saying, okay, how can we direct this campaign using all these different tools?
You're describing a sort of vertical integration of the political smear.
That's right, yeah. One of the things that was continually used against Sinclair was that he was a free love advocate, some sort of wild living radical, almost what you might call a hippie bohemian and so forth. This was because there were characters in his books who had these traits. He was a vegetarian, you know, which at that time was seen as somehow un-American. So he had some personal traits, but the odd thing was he was such a straight-laced, not in any way a free spirit that they pictured him as, so many people had moved to California from the Midwest, and the Dust Bowl was a big, big church-going state. So Sinclair certainly was looked down upon by many of those people.
So were you convinced that it was the negative advertising that took down Upton Sinclair?
I think after coming off his primary win, which is at the very end of August, the Epic campaign was an incredible mass movement. I mean, they had 800 chapters around the state. They had a weekly newspaper that had 2 million circulation. I would say that if these new techniques and over-the-top, incredible, dirty tricks had not been employed, that Sinclair would have narrowly won.
It strikes me that if lying during a campaign is a crime against democracy, then what this campaign of Upton Sinclair teaches us is that crime pays.
Well, we certainly see to this day the attack ads, and you know, this year as much as ever, and there's all kinds of new money coming into campaigns. One thing that's different, I would say, is today a lot of the campaign tricks eventually get exposed. We've seen any number of races in recent years that have sort of turned on YouTube videos or some sort of blog exposés. We just saw this fall the rather humorous case of the Republican campaign in West Virginia, which shot a commercial with supposed to be average folks sitting around a diner and trashing the Democratic candidate. Via the web and other sources, it was discovered that they had sent out a casting call for actors. They called hickey-looking actors. So I thought of the Thalberg hiring of bums for the newsreels. This commercial was dropped in West Virginia because it had been exposed.
Greg, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Greg Mitchell is author of The Campaign of the Century, Upton Sinclair's Race for Governor and the Birth of Media Politics. The presidency will be decided in 4 weeks. Syria is in flames and Spain is on the economic brink. But that's not why representatives from the Associated Press, Reuters, CBS News, The Today Show, Time.com, USA Today, and 10 other news organizations filled a press tent this week on New York City's Pier 54. No, as Bob discovered, they were on to something shocking.
That was the sound of electricity arcing around David Blaine, the human endurance virtuoso. He stood on a platform in a Faraday suit, named after the 19th century pioneer of electromagnetism. The getup is basically 27 pounds of chainmail, a wire helmet, and a pair of steel-plated work boots demonstrating the marvel of high-voltage, low-amperage alternating current conceived of in the 1890s by Serbian inventor Nikola Tesla. Just a quick zap or two. This was a preview of Blaine's attempt this weekend to stand upright and sleepless for 3 days with a million volts of electricity coursing around him and many lightning bolts sparking colorfully outwards from his extremities. And the press was duly impressed. Among them, Muhammad Awad, a cameraman for Reuters Television.
You know, I think I covered David years and years. I'm not first time cover him.
And is he still interesting to you, or is it just another David Blaine?
It's interesting. This story, amazing story now, with electricity. It's really dangerous.
Ostentatious danger has placed David Blaine famously at the nexus of performance art and publicity stunt. Whether being frozen for nearly 62 hours in a block of ice or standing for 35 hours unsecured on a 10-story high pillar or being dangled for 44 days in a plexiglass box over the Thames, he knows how to attract attention. Though the media are supposedly wary of manipulation, in this press tent, skepticism and world weariness seem to have taken a holiday. I spoke, for instance, to Sonia Rincon, of
all news, all the time. This is 1010 Wins. You give us 22 minutes, we'll give you the world.
When you got the assignment, did you go, or did you go, cool?
The latter. I definitely thought it was cool.
Right, one quick follow-up question. Are you lying?
No. I do think it's cool.
But why? This I inquired of Terry Pose of Time.com.
What do you suppose it is about human beings that we are drawn to sights of other human beings in extremis?
It's, you know, just a classic freak show, like P.T. Barnum. We want to see people doing weird things that we wouldn't do, and we want to look at them, and almost like a zoo. You know, we want to put everything on display like that.
What if he dies?
It'd be really great news.
You mean, not great news, but great news.
Sure, yeah.
Let's just assume Blaine will survive 3 days of zapping, just as he survived the block of ice, the perch on the 10-story high tower, and the 44 days imprisoned in plexiglass. A few other questions remain, including the obvious one I posed to David Blaine.
Does your mother know what you do for a living?
For mothers, I think it's good to bring the kids and explain to them. Explain who Tesla is. Explain why he's amazing. Explain what alternating currents are. How is this possible? Who's Faraday? What is a Faraday? So I think there is a lot of good things that mothers could show the kids.
Aha! So it's not just daredevilish. It's also educational and interactive. Through the miracle of internet streaming, people in cities around the world, even as I speak, are standing at installations of Intel computers and participating in real time.
You know, we have these computers, the Ultrabooks, that Intel gave us to control the entire environment. So you can push buttons and you can affect the arcs, you can affect the power, you can affect the electricity.
So please touch electrocution. The idea was born at a Hollywood dinner party where Blaine met Intel's Johan Javer, where commenced a collaboration to captivate the world. The artist gets underwritten to do what the artist does, and Intel gets to promote its Ultrabook, the notebook-tablet hybrid that to date has failed to electrify the marketplace. The theme of the whole spectacle is always on, referring both to 3 days of constant electrification and the Ultrabook's ultra-long battery life. It's a match made in heaven, so long as the Blaine-ness of the stunt doesn't drown out the Intel-ness. But Javer said, no chance of that.
The whole project is created with Ultrabook and is run by Ultrabooks. I think you will see that the content that is created and how people are consuming and involved will get equal excitement on both David, obviously, him being, you know, the performer of this, as well as for Intel.
He's probably right, although the dynamics of spectacle, public fascination, and artistic desire aren't always in sync. When I asked Blaine to muse on the attraction of his exploits, he invoked the Franz Kafka story titled A Hunger Artist. It was about a sideshow performer whose talent was being locked in a cage without access to food for weeks at a time.
And he slowly starts to disappear. At the end of The Hunger Artist, they're all looking and nobody's in there because he's dissipated completely, but everybody's there to see it.
Actually, in the story, he's still in there, but dwindling and dying, and is eventually buried with the straw in his cage. By the time he dies, no one is there to see it. The crowds have long since lost interest. Happily, there's no chance of that this weekend.
Magician David Blaine gives a preview of his most shocking stunt yet, using his body to conduct 1 million volts of electricity.
He might not say much, but David Blaine has an electric personality. And now the bright spark is planning his latest stunt.
He'll have a doctor monitoring him and EMT standing by in case he gets electrocuted, which he says shouldn't happen as long as he doesn't touch his face. Sonia Rincon, 1010 Winds at Pier 54 on the west side.
In other words, it's not just the Ultrabook battery and 72 hours of Tesla coiling. When a classic freak show is in town, the media, too, are always on.
Are you worried that for it was ice, it was water, now it's electricity, that you're going to run out of places to be hungry and tired in?
I don't think I can ever top this thing, ever.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, and Doug Anderson, with more help from Lita Martinez, Ariel Stolberg, and Andy Lancet. And the show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was James Coyle.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts and read our fabulous blog at onthemedia.org. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter, and you can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
And just a note, next week we're devoting the whole hour to the election. We'll consider the kind of mental jujitsu that voters perform upon themselves. Scientists tell us that when a candidate is mendacious or hypocritical, his or her supporters are actually wired to lie to themselves about it.
They got this huge blast of dopamine, which is involved in reward, feeling good about the fact that they had completely fooled themselves.
Next week, why the rational parts of your brain go dark when you enter the political realm.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.